This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 88 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be talking about Season 1 of Star Trek, the original series, as we dive into our essential Trek philosophy for the original series, Season 1. Zachary, how are you today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be recording Metatrex again. It's been a couple of weeks since we've had a chance to record, and I'm so excited to talk about Star Trek, the original series, Season 1, where it all began.
And let me tell you something. I'm gonna start right off the bat by saying it was such a difficult task to try and pull a handful of episodes out of this season, because quite frankly, there's only one episode in Season 1 that I think you can toss out. This is just a matter of my own opinion. Shore Leave, I think, is just one I can leave on the table.
You don't like Shore Leave?
I don't like Shore Leave, but the rest of the episodes in this season, even going to the original pilot, which was used later on for Episode 15 and 16, Menagerie Part 1 and 2, this is just cram-packed full of great philosophy. These stories are just rich, and there's just not a bad egg in the bunch, except, of course, for Shore Leave.
As we record this in 2018, there are over 750 hours of Star Trek on television, and all of that Star Trek rests on Star Trek, the original series, Season 1. If Season 1 hadn't been as strong as it had been, the show would never have been renewed for a second season, wouldn't have made it three seasons, we never would have had Star Trek The Next Generation, and all of the Star Trek, and by extension, Star Trek and philosophy that we have now, we owe directly to the strength of Season 1 of the original series. And you can go episode by episode by episode, and from episode to episode, the shows are filled with ideas, filled with inspiration, filled with commentary on the human condition. And that season is just so strong. And when you watch the season as a whole, which I didn't have time to do, admittedly, but I've done in the past. I would like to say I watched the whole season to prep for today's episode, but didn't get that far. But when you watch Season 1 of the original series, it's easy to be amazed at how strong it really is. It's such an idea-rich show compared to everything else that was on television at the time.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And quite frankly, when you stack this up against every other iteration of Star Trek, I think that Season 1 of the original series just wins hands down against any other season of Star Trek, bar none. It's just loaded full of great content, and frankly, I think it's just as on point today as it was, you know, in the 1960s when it was first airing on television.
It's such a strong season of Star Trek that I had a hard time following our traditional method that we use for our Essential Trek Philosophy episodes. Usually you and I pick three or five episodes from a season of Star Trek as the most essential Trek philosophy from that season. But this season is so strong, I just plain couldn't follow that method. So I broke our own rules, and I'm not going to do that today for this episode of Essential Trek Philosophy. What I did, I whittled down the season a little bit. I have a larger number of episodes, somewhere like 12 or 15 episodes, and I've categorized them because what I found is that these episodes philosophically fit into themes in a way that episodes in other seasons of Star Trek don't seem to. You could tell where Gene Roddenberry's head was at when he was working on the first season of Star Trek, because, and we'll talk about what these themes are, but I came up with four themes that I think are the most interesting themes in season one. And one of those themes is overwhelmingly the most significant, the largest volume of material in that season. So what can we infer from that about Gene Roddenberry's mindset at the time, what he was interested in? I'm not really sure, but I think it's interesting that you can categorize philosophically these episodes and one category is overwhelmingly larger than the other. We'll talk about that when we dive in.
And just so our listeners realize that you and I never share notes on our picks for Essential Trek Philosophy, I literally did not know that you had broken the rules until we got on the turbo lift here on the Starship Theseus. We are literally talking about this in real time. I had no idea you had broken the rules. I had a very difficult time coming up with a list. I came up with a list of four and two honorable mentions. And quite honestly, I was sitting there looking at my list going, but what about this episode? And what about this episode? And what about this episode? It was so difficult. And for you to have categorized those, breaking the rules, yes, but I think it's really fascinating the way you've kind of categorized these, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
What was interesting about this exercise of trying to categorize these episodes, and again, not every episode in this season made my list. A lot of them did make the list. What was interesting, though, is the way in which a lot of them are variations on a same theme. It's almost as if Gene Roddenberry and the writers were playing, had a very high idea theme in mind, and were exploring that theme in different ways, different nuances, different perspectives over the course of season one. So it's the reason I couldn't whittle down the list is that I think the playfulness of exploring the same idea in different ways with different nuances, with different characters, different emphases, is part of the fun of season one of the original series, both philosophically and from an entertainment standpoint.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because as I was going through, and I've done four rewatches of the original series, apart from the fact that I saw most of these in rerun as a child. So, you know, here I am now as an adult. I've done, you know, four kind of rewatches through the original series. Like you, I didn't have time to sit down and watch the original series season one in preparation for this podcast. I'm going largely off of memory, although I did watch a couple of episodes, but
you apparently didn't like Shore Leave when you were younger.
I didn't. giant white rabbits, that's just creepy. You know, when you're 5 years old, that's just creepy, Zach.
Well, you see, I did watch Shore Leave when I was younger, and I remember finding it quite, it was childish, but it was also just fun and out of the ordinary and interesting. And I still like Shore Leave to this day. So there.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. It's kind of a fun, happy-go-lucky kind of episode, but it's not, most people dislike Spock's brain. I like Spock's brain. I would take Spock's brain over Shore Leave any day.
I got to say, I'd probably take Shore Leave.
So, you know, hey, listeners, why don't you all chime in too? Or are you Team Shore Leave or Team Spock's brain? I have a feeling I'm going to be on the short end of that poll, but
we'll see.
We'll see. So chime in, go to the Babel conference and find the show thread and let us know. Are you Team Shore Leave or Team Spock's brain? Or maybe you're one of those people that say, I don't like either one of them. Comment in the show thread. But you know, Zachary, I did notice as I was going through these that there are themes kind of throughout the season. In fact, one of my honorable mentions is an honorable mention because I felt like it was an exploration of a theme that had already been covered earlier in the season of season one of the original series. And I felt like that earlier episode was a slightly better exploration of that theme. So I'm going to be interested to see what themes you kind of honed in on and how you categorize the episodes within these themes. As we go along here, obviously I've got less episodes on my list than you have, I'll certainly be sharing my list as well. So with that in mind, shall we dive in?
Let's do it.
All right. You want to give us, say, your first theme and perhaps the episodes that you think might fit within that theme.
Well, Mike, I thought I would start by giving an overview of what the four themes that I found are. The first one we're very familiar with because we've talked about it many times on Metatreks and many other seasons of Star Trek and many other episodes of Star Trek. And this is, I think, the simplest theme to understand. Moral choices. Ethical conundrums, having to choose between doing one thing and doing another thing, evaluating consequences, evaluating the moral principles at play. So one theme right off the bat, a simple, easy to understand ethical theme is just moral choices. But believe it or not, that's actually the least significant theme that I found of the four themes that I found. And so small, I only found one episode that really traditionally fits the bill of a traditional moral choice and evaluating consequences in a utilitarian kind of sense. The second theme that I found is actually the most significant of the themes. This is the one I had a hard time really whittling down and even giving a precise label. I would describe this second theme as transhumanism, future evolution of humanity. What are the potential that humanity has? What kinds of beings could we evolve into, whether morally or biologically? And in parentheses, the second half of this one theme is judging humanity from a higher standpoint. Many times in season one of the original series, the crew of the Enterprise encounters some sort of aliens that are advanced in some way. They take the position of moral superiority. They're the judges of what human nature is and what humans are doing. And Star Trek is very critical of godlike beings, and these kinds of episodes kind of fall into two little subcategories. One of the subcategories involves encountering a false god-type being that is advanced in some way but has some sort of moral flaw because of that advancement. But the second category is encountering an alien species that's genuinely superior. They do have peace, and they're pacifists, and they look down on the flaws of humanity. We can look up to those aliens as something we could become someday, and you can see the Gene Roddenberry playing with the idea of what we could become given our full potential. And the aliens that have achieved that, looking down and kind of criticizing or examining or evaluating humanity from a moral standpoint, almost like Q does in season one of Star Trek, the original series, putting humanity on trial. There's a sense in which humanity is being judged by these morally superior aliens that are genuinely pacifists or genuinely don't understand the warlike nature of humankind.
Or in the case of Q, genuinely narcissistic.
Yeah, absolutely. Q's a little different, of course. So this is a fairly large category, and I actually have 10 episodes inside this category that explore this notion in various ways. And they not in the same way. These aren't the same episode repeated 10 times. These are 10 different variations on this theme, playing with that idea in different ways. So that's theme number two, and I'm anxious to talk about that one because I think overwhelmingly that's the largest theme inside season one of the original series. The third theme that I found is an exploration of human nature. In parentheses, I put good versus evil. What is that inner moral struggle that we have, doing the right thing versus doing the wrong thing, being benevolent but being selfish? You know, that kind of inner, an introspective inner look at human nature internally, rather than judged from without, like in the second category. And the fourth theme that I found is the ethics of war. There are a couple of episodes that are somewhat particularly tied to the Cold War mindset in the 60s, but have some interesting things to say about the ethics of war, and I've got a couple of episodes that fall in that category. And those four categories overwhelmingly, I think, exhaust the philosophically interesting material in season one of the original series.
Well, Zachary, as we go through these, and again, I know that your list is much larger than my own, and I have a pretty good suspicion that my six episodes that I've selected from season one are probably going to bear out in one of these categories and perhaps even on your list. So I'm just going to let you kick this off. You want to begin with moral choices, ethical conundrums?
Absolutely. Like I said, this is the smallest category on my list because there's really only one episode I found that falls neatly into this category. And I think you might be able to guess what it is. It is The City on the Edge of Forever. In that episode, Captain Kirk has to face the choice of letting Edith Keeler die for the sake of saving the future, preserving the world as he knows it. And you can characterize that dilemma as a straightforward utilitarian dilemma, right? Do you sacrifice one person to save all the people in the future and future, the future itself, the future that they know, their own past, of course, their own history. But from the point of view of the 20th century, it's the future. So put in that way, I think you can characterize The City on the Edge of Forever as a straightforward moral dilemma. Do you save Edith Keeler or do you let Edith Keeler die? Is there a difference even between killing someone actively and passively letting Edith Keeler die like Captain Kirk does inside the episode? These are interesting ethical questions about the nature of utilitarianism. And even Kantian ethics, you know, whether there's a genuine moral difference between, you know, if Captain Kirk had pushed Edith Keeler in front of the car, would that have been different than passively standing back and letting the car hit her and not intervening? Is there a moral difference there? We don't want to go into depth on any of those materials today because this is more of an overview of the entire season of Star Trek. But I think if you were looking for a straightforward ethical dilemma, that this is the clearest example that you're going to find in season one of the original series.
Yeah, as I think about City on the Edge of Forever, and obviously it is number one on my list, and I can't say enough about how I feel about City on the Edge of Forever in terms of its position within Star Trek as a whole. I think it is definitely on my top five list of Star Trek episodes for a lot of reasons. This is such a strong episode. In terms of its philosophical content, I think you're exactly right. And I find myself, as I think about City, I find myself asking the question, you know, WWKD, what would Kant do? Because I think that's a major consideration within the episode. I also found it interesting that we are passively dealing with the idea of determinism here in this episode. We are looking at the effect of one person's life and this kind of trickle down, and it really begs the question, you know, do we have any control over the trajectory of our lives and the impact of our lives in the universe as a whole? And so there's just, again, not enough that I can say about this episode. And I know it's a fan favorite. It's a fan favorite for a reason. And I have a sneaky suspicion that most fans probably would include this on a top 5, top 10, top 20 type list of Star Trek episodes. It's powerful.
But can you think of another episode that fits neatly into the moral dilemma category besides this episode? I actually had a hard time finding any other episode that has a straightforward choose A or choose B, these consequences versus those consequences kind of structure.
Yeah, Zachary, I think that's a great question. And I think what we see here in City on the Edge of Forever really is it's a trolley problem. It's you know, if you turn to the left, it's one life. If you turn to the right, it's, you know, it's the entire future as they know it. So it is a bit of a trolley problem, and I think it's unique in that respect in season one. But I think there are actually a lot of episodes where there are these kind of difficult moral and ethical choices, these conundrums that kind of pop up. I think we see it in episodes like, for instance, Menagerie. You know, Spock has essentially made a difficult ethical choice. He's risking his career as a Starfleet officer to help his friend Captain Pike. I think we see it early on with episodes like Where No Man Has Gone Before, Charlie X. I think there are a lot of episodes where we see these types of difficult moral and ethical choices in the midst of these conundrums. But I think what makes City on the Edge of Forever very unique is that it really is this quintessential trolley problem.
I was honestly very surprised, Mike. If we were talking about a season of Star Trek The Next Generation or a season of Deep Space Nine, this is all we'd be talking about. We'd be talking about consequentialism versus Kantian ethics, this trolley problem versus that trolley problem. And those kinds of dilemmas are rampant in the later iterations of Star Trek. I was actually just surprised how few episodes display that kind of moral conundrum. And I was equally surprised by the extent to which there was a preoccupation with things like human nature and future human potential. Overwhelmingly, that was the emphasis of season one, in my view, of the original series, and significantly less emphasis on what I would consider traditional ethical moral dilemmas in a trolley problem sense.
Yeah, I agree completely. But I think there are a lot of episodes from season one, I think, that could fall into this category, moral choices and ethical conundrums. I do believe that City on the Edge of Forever, Zachary, is by far the best choice from the entire list of season one.
And I would go so far as to say even the other episodes that have some element of a moral or ethical conundrum, a decision-making problem, choose A or choose B, that is the secondary theme in the episode, that the theme of future human potential is the dominant theme even in those episodes.
Yeah, I agree completely. So, Zachary, that leads us to your next category, which is transhumanism.
Well, I worried about this category a little bit because it's a pretty broad category. I had a hard time making smaller categories out of this category. By transhumanism, I just meant future human potential. What could humanity evolve into? And by extension, I included episodes where humanity is being judged from outside by a more evolved alien race, because I think the purpose of those episodes is to force us to think, what is our potential? What could we evolve into? What could our moral or ethical progress be in the future evolution of mankind? So it's a pretty broad category. I probably could make smaller categories out of it if I really tried. But I felt like all of those separate questions are variations on this broad theme of overall future human potential. So transhumanism would be one way to put it. The future potential of mankind, judging humanity from a higher state of consciousness or from a higher evolved alien races standpoint, all of those seem like variations on this one fairly broad theme to me. So right off the bat, my first episode in this category is The Cage, where it all began, the unaired pilot episode of Star Trek.
Okay.
Right off the bat in The Cage, we've got the Talosians putting mankind in what's essentially a zoo for evaluation. And what better way to set up this question of what is the potential of mankind is to put them in a zoo like a lab rat and look at their potential, what they could be. Now, of course, with the Talosians, you know, they're advanced in some ways and they're morally inept in other ways. And it's an interesting duality of being advanced but also having some sort of crucial moral flaws that conflicts with traditional human values. So there's a dual nature of the Talosians. They're advanced in some ways, but they're not as advanced morally as humans, as we find out in the course of the episode. But I just think the concept of putting humans in what's essentially under a microscope in a zoo is a fascinating way to take the third-person alien perspective on human nature.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't have The Cage on my list. For that matter, I didn't include The Menagerie on my list. And anytime I think of The Cage, although I think The Cage standalone by itself is a phenomenal episode of Star Trek, and it's a shame because I know that there are a lot of fans of Star Trek who have never taken the time to watch The Cage because, you know, it's the original pilot, it's not Captain Kirk, it's, you know, it's something different. And if you're one of those fans, I want to just encourage you to sit down and watch The Cage in and of itself, apart from The Menagerie. I love what they did with, you know, basically they had this entire episode that ended up on the cutting room floor, as it were. It was a scrapped pilot that was rejected by the studio. And I love the fact that Gene Roddenberry was able to recycle it if you will, and make it a part of this wonderful original canon of the original series, season one. But I didn't put it on my list because while I like you, I find it fascinating that, you know, humanity's been put in a zoo. And I think there's an incredible message there that we could probably do a whole episode, you know, just kind of breaking this down and talking about it. I just didn't feel that in light of all of the other episodes that we had, you know, throughout the season, that it said something that, for instance, was equal to in any way what we got in City and the Edge of Forever. And I'm trying not to, you know, reveal any of my other picks, but I think there are just too many other great episodes that I think dealt with more heady and heavy topics than what we kind of got in the Menagerie. I love the Menagerie. I love the Cage as episodes. I think they're fantastic. They're some of the earliest memories of the original series that I have from watching when I was a young boy. The Talosians were, you know, I thought as an alien species, you know, for the early 1970s, the pulsating on their heads that they did with little balloons under the makeup. So I've got really vivid memories of this episode. And I think it's fantastic. It's just not as heady and heavy as some of the other episodes that we got in season one.
You know, I think the thing I find interesting about this theme or this category of episodes in general is that any one of these episodes is only, I think, marginally interesting. But you put them all together and you get a fairly nuanced interplay of questions about human nature and questions about human potential that, taken as a whole, represent a very playful exploration of what our potential is, what our strengths and our weaknesses are as a race, as a people.
What else falls under transhumanism?
Okay, so I've got the Arena.
Okay.
In the Arena, we have the Metrons, who are, again, evaluating humanity from this more advanced alien race standpoint. In this case, the Metrons are evaluating our ability to overcome our violent instincts.
Okay.
Again, raising the question, what is our potential? Can we overcome this baser, more instinctive nature and attain a higher level of thinking about these things?
And again, I don't have the Arena on my list. There's a sense to me in this episode of Esperance, of Hope. It says to me that man is able to overcome, you know, their violent and suspicious nature, you know, in spite of, you know, in this case, the Metrion kind of sets up this this duel between the Gorn and Captain Kirk, and you know, we get that kind of epic struggle that goes on within this episode. And, you know, to me, I think it speaks to what we were talking about with City on the Edge of Forever, these moral choices, these ethical conundrums. You know, there's certainly a lot of that going on within the episode. But I do agree that I think the overall theme is this idea of man being evaluated by seemingly more evolved species. I think that's a fair assessment. But again, I think it's also laden with these, you know, kind of moral choices and, you know, this difficult situation that they found themselves in, and how are they going to respond?
Well, it's amazing how many times this actually comes up in the course of season one of the original series. Not only do we have the Talosians in the Cage, not only do we have the Metrons in Arena, but now we have the Organians playing essentially the same role. They step back and take the third-person perspective, evaluating humanity's ability to find a peaceful, nonviolent solution with the Klingons, and essentially forcing humans to do it in the case of the Organians.
Sure.
Playing a much more active role rather than just standing back and, well, unlike the Metrons in the Arena, who basically comment, they basically set up the situation, and at the end of the day, they tell Captain Kirk, you've got potential, we believe in you, you'll evolve like to be like us someday, we trust you. You're not all bad.
Yeah, maybe in a few thousand years, yeah.
Right, exactly. The Organians are a bit more proactive. They basically force the pacification of the situation between humans and Klingons. And it's interesting that that came later in the series. It's almost like there was an evolution in thought, almost like a second guessing oneself. You know, the arena is very optimistic, right? The Metrons are like, oh, you'll get here someday. No problem. We'll just wait a few thousand years, like you said, and you'll evolve to be peaceful. Whereas the basic thesis of the Errand of Mercy is that humans are not able to do that, at least not right now, and they need to forcibly be pacified.
The thing that I love about this particular episode is, you know, we talk a lot on our podcast here about hermeneutics. And I think there's a really great kind of hermeneutical question that we can ask about this episode. You know, we first of all, we realize that this episode really takes the perspective of the Organians. They're pacifists, and they're rather appalled by the territorialism of these two species, you know, the humans and the Klingons. And, you know, these are two species that they're territorial and they're adversarial, and the Organians are just kind of fed up with it. And like you said, you're absolutely right. They kind of force, you know, their pacifism onto them. And I think it's interesting because at the time that this was written, I think that there is a commentary here about, you know, kind of this this Cold War mentality, I think, that was prevalent in the 1960s, and even quite possibly, you know, some commentary about you know, America's involvement in the Vietnam War. I think certainly, you know, you can find nuances of the story, I think, that speak to that a little bit. But I do love, Zachary, the timelessness of the message and what I think it says, you know, to us today. Because let's face it, you know, since the original series era 51 or so years ago, you know, we've not evolved a whole lot in terms of...
Well, you raise an interesting question. The question that you're raising is the message of these episodes inherently a political message? Is it more about social commentary based on the political dynamics of the 1960s and issues of global war, whether it's the Cold War, whether it's Vietnam? Or are these episodes fundamentally about human nature and future human potential? I kind of took the human nature reading of these episodes, but that's partly because I grew up at the tail end of the Cold War and I wasn't living in the height of the Cold War, and I don't identify with the fear associated with the Cold War era. I grew up in the 1980s, which is essentially a more optimistic time. We weren't really worried about nuclear war, even though the Cold War hadn't ended. And, we weren't worried about World War III in the 1980s so much. So when I was watching the original series, those weren't issues top of my mind. And those issues are there. They're definitely, you know, historical hermeneutical questions. But for me, the timeless message is the question about human nature. Can we as a people evolve into something better? And that's a timeless question, not a spatio-temporally located question based on the 1960s.
Sure. And I have to say that it's almost in some respects laughable. You know, at the end of this episode, you know, basically they confabulate a little bit, and, you know, the problem is at least temporarily solved, right? When we realize that it doesn't dissolve the tensions between humans and Klingons by a long shot. But I do appreciate the kind of 1960s way that they wrap the episode up. And again, I think that the overall message there was, you know, the it was a political one. It was about diplomacy and communication and how that can really reduce tensions and at least help find common ground, you know, to move forward from. So I think there's a strong political message in there for the era that it was certainly written in, but I think it's one that translates very well today, and I think fits into your category of transhumanism very well.
Another episode that I find fits nicely into this category is The Return of the Archons.
Okay.
And the theme that I see in this episode that's related is dependence on technology. You know, as we become increasingly technological, will we become dependent on technology in some way? It's almost a critique of the radical improvements in technology that were happening in the 1960s as well.
Yeah, and again, I find it interesting because there are a number of episodes of Star Trek, both here in the original series and Next Generation and so on, that I think from time to time, a series that is so heavily influenced by not just emerging technology, Zachary, but you know, we've discussed many times, and I know we've had this discussion on many other of the podcasts here on Trek.fm about how Star Trek in a lot of ways influenced the innovation of technology over the course of time. And so here is a series that is just very much, you know, laden with technology. And this is kind of critical of the part, the role that technology plays in our day-to-day lives. And I think it's interesting that, you know, we were having this conversation long before, you know, personal computing was a thing, long before, you know, we had these things called smartphones and Twitter and Facebook. And
well, you have to remember at the time there were computers, but they were computers that were run by governments and they were run by corporations. Mm-hmm. IBM had computers.
Sure.
These were not friendly personal computers, right,
right,
as we know them today. These were room-sized monstrosities. These were machines that were part of a massive government / university military industrial complex. These were things to be afraid of. So Star Trek, from the beginning, had an interesting dual relationship with technology. Technology allows us to have the Enterprise, allows us to have all the technological gadgets that we see, even in the original series, hypo sprays and all kinds of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it also creates this latent fear. In the worst case scenario, we end up with a society like we see in Return of the Archons, a society that's entirely dependent on technology.
Right.
And in the Next Generation, that idea gets carried even further. Worst case scenario, technology evolves into the Borg. So there is this kind of dual relationship with technology. It's something that enables us to be the best versions of ourselves, but it also can enable the worst versions of ourselves and can undercut our ability to reach our full potential.
I just find it fascinating that, you know, of course, I wasn't even thinking within this realm when I put my list together. So I don't have Arena. I don't have Errand of Mercy. I don't have Return of the Archons. This wasn't even on my radar when I put my list together. But there are, as I look at the episodes going down through season one, there are, Zachary, probably half of the episodes in season one, I think, can fall under this category and really follow the same line of exploration and thought that these episodes that you have here in under this banner of transhumanism kind of do.
A related episode that I very nearly put in this category, but I actually decided to put it in my next category of philosophical themes, is The Conscience of the King. We get an explicit discussion about humanity not turning into a mechanized society, kind of retaining our liberal arts character inside that episode. But that was not the dominant theme of the episode. That's kind of the B plot inside The Conscience of the King. But I could have put The Conscience of the King in that category as well.
Mm.
But there are a few of these. So yeah, we've got this commentary on being dependent on technology and Return of the Archons. We also have Space Seed, a direct commentary on genetic engineering, that if we try to improve ourselves, we might end up with a Khan-Noonien Singh.
Is that on your list?
Yeah, in the same category for that very same reason. Future okay. human potential, future human evolution. If we try to improve ourselves, do we end up improving ourselves or do we become something more like Khan?
And I think the interesting thing about Space Seed is that it's this very futuristic story, but within the story, Khan is actually from the past. So, you know,
But he's superior.
He's superior. Yeah, we've been there. We've done that. We've got the shirt. We've moved on. And, you know, but now we're being sized up and judged by someone from humanity's past who feels that he and those like him have transcended us as human beings and are in every way superior. I think that's fascinating. Again, Space Seed is not on my list, but you know, a great episode that I think you're exactly right. And again, the thing that I find fascinating about this is that, you know, in many ways, Khan is from our future, but he's actually from Kirk's past. And so it's not just a superior alien race that we found out there in space. It's, you know, it's a human being from a dark period of human past who is sizing us up and judging us.
Well, put in those terms, it's actually yet another variation on humanity being judged from the third person. It's not as plausible as being judged by something as advanced as the Organians or as advanced as the Metrons. But insofar as Khan thinks of himself as being superior and being more evolved in some way, he's taking mm-hmm. this third person, you know, Greek chorus kind of commentary on human nature. I would say another episode that's directly along the same lines is Where No Man Has Gone Before. In that episode, we've got Gary Mitchell, who's essentially been given superpowers. And it's an interesting question. What happens if you have a human being with superpowers? Is that something that's corrupting? Or is that something... Do you end up with Superman or do you end up with Gary Mitchell? I think it's sure. an interesting question.
I was going to kind of wait until you got to sort of the end of your list. And there, I was going to name off just a couple of these. Again, these aren't on my list. I wasn't even thinking in this vein when I put my list together. But I think Charlie X to a small degree. I certainly think that Squire of Gothos is one of those episodes. These are superior beings who are almost amused by humanity as though they were playthings. Kind of the same amusement that I get, you know, from something silly that my dog does. You know, when I throw a ball or pretend to throw a ball. You do that with your dog. You pretend to throw a ball, and the dog takes off running after it, only to realize that it's not been. That's a lot of these episodes. I feel are that kind of scenario.
I would go so far as to say they're all Q prototypes.
I think that's very fair, and I think that's a great commentary. In fact, I would be interested to find out from, you know, whomever it is out there in Star Trek production universe that came up with character Q, you know, just how much the character was influenced. I know there have been a lot of kind of fan chats about Squire of Gothos really being the Q. For the original series, and I think that's a fair argument, and there's certainly one to be made there.
But I think you can extend that to Gary Mitchell, and you can extend that to Charlie, and yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's clearly Gene Roddenberry's thinking. This is something that I think clearly preoccupied Gene Roddenberry's thoughts, given the overwhelming emphasis of this theme in season one of the original series, and given Gene Roddenberry's consultancy role in creating Star Trek: The Next Generation. I think this is Gene Roddenberry's persistent thought along these lines.
I'm inclined to agree with you on that. And certainly there is no season of Star Trek probably that has had more of Gene Roddenberry's influence than season one of the original series. And so I echo that 100%.
So I have more in this category. I also have What Are Little Girls Made Of? In that episode, we get a very interesting question. Will humans be able to evolve to the point where we could shed the biological and transfer our consciousness into android bodies? Is that a future improvement of mankind?
I almost put What Are Little Girls Made Of on my list for that very reason. And for that matter, for 1960s science fiction television, I thought this episode was so cutting edge. I think the story that it's telling here is so far beyond what anything else that we would have seen, you know, 1967 on television. And I'm not even sure in terms of science fiction literature. I mean, this was heady stuff, you know, for the late 1960s that I think really transcends the time in which it was made.
Well, it asks so many interesting questions about our future potential. If we evolved to the point where we could transfer our consciousnesses to alien bodies, mm-hmm. we would lose all the weaknesses and all of the defects associated with the biological, right?
Yeah.
But this episode says we would also lose an important part of our humanity. And Roger Corby is clearly not himself. It's revealed at the end of the episode. It's not Roger Corby anymore. He doesn't have the same humanity to him. He's lost something important. On the other hand, you know, he gets to be essentially eternal. He gets to become an old one one day.
Mm-hmm.
It raises the interesting question about whether life would be worth living if you get to essentially be an eternal being like Ruck in the episode.
Right.
It's funny you say it's advanced. I laugh every time I see the shots of the android open up, like the phaser wound or the scratch on Roger Corby's hand, because I just laugh at the idea of having these androids with discrete components, like these massive capacitors and resistors showing, because the integrated circuit hadn't become prominent at that point yet, so no one knew what that was. So if you were going to create something electronic, of course it would have these big clunky can-shaped capacitors and that kind of thing.
Right, right. I think the thing that I find fascinating about this particular storyline is that we saw it so many times, not just over the course of other iterations of Star Trek, but we saw these types of stories pop up in other seasons of the original series, and then certainly it was repeated. I mean, we've got consciousness going into light bulbs and computers, and we're taking human consciousness and putting it into androids, and I mean, this is a recurring theme in Star Trek.
And this is a theme that carries over even into Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm thinking of the episode The Schizoid Man, where Grandpa gets transferred into into Data.
Well, then that's exactly what I was referencing when I said, you know, we're transferring human consciousness over into androids, you know, to know him is to love him, to, you know.
Well, it's
almost laughable, but it's borrowing, really, I think, by and large from, you know, what we're seeing right here in the original series.
Well, you know, Nurse Chapel did say that about Roger Corby. To know him is to love him is to know him.
I think she said that about Spock, too, so.
Several times in the course of
I think so.
The original series. So I have more, believe it or not, in this category. I think you could plausibly put Miri in this category.
I think you're right about that.
In Miri, you get the idea that for all of our medical advances, we could still invent a plague that wipes ourselves out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a commentary on the danger. Again, it's sort of a subspecies of you know, being skeptical about technology and the dangers of technology. This is plausibly a commentary on the dangers of medical technology.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think there's a tremendous commentary here because, again, we're dealing with an era in which many countries throughout the world were dealing with chemical weapons and biological weapons, and, you know, they're experimenting and they're developing these things. And, you know, here's Star Trek saying, stop it. This is bad. The potential is devastating. And they were able to do this, Zachary, because they used something as benign as a science fiction program. And, you know, they were able to address, I think, in real ways, a lot of the political and social problems that, you know, that were going on right there in the 1960s.
So I have one more episode in this category, and I kind of tacked this one on at the end, and I'm not 100% convinced it belongs in this category, but it belongs enough where I put it on my list. I put Dagger of the Mind.
Okay.
Because it raises the question of whether we will ever get to the point where we have a more evolved view of crime and punishment. Will we evolve in our perspective on how we should treat people who are functionally criminals, but this episode kind of makes the claim that really it's a question of brokenness. We need to treat them more sympathetically and treat them rather than punishing criminals. So, you know, it's not transhumanism per se, but it is making the claim that there's a more evolved perspective that mankind will evolve into along the lines of punishment. So again, does it really belong in this category? I'm not sure, but I tacked it on there anyway.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those topics that somebody there in the Star Trek writers' room was caught up in it enough that, you know, it pops up again in future episodes. Whom Gods Destroy comes to mind from the third season, that I think in many ways has the same message. It's told in a completely different way, and it's a completely different scenario, but it really is addressing the same moral and social and ethical problem that the Dagger of the Mind does. And so, yeah, I agree. And I think it's fair that it's on the list and in this particular category. So none of those, Zachary, were on my list at all. And again, I've said it several times, I just was not thinking at all in this vein as I was kind of choosing and picking, following the rules, as it were.
I think that's what's fun about what happens when we do these Essential Trek Philosophy episodes, because your interests and my interests overlap, but they're not the same. And
right.
My philosophical experience and your philosophical experience overlap, but they don't match up one to one.
Right.
So I see nuances you don't see, or I find, you know, things interesting that you don't find as philosophically interesting, or it's not what you recognize instinctively in the episodes, mm-hmm. and vice versa. And I find it fascinating that I had this one broad category with all these episodes, and none of these were really on your radar philosophically.
Yeah, I mean, 9 episodes that you had packed into this category, transhumanism, and I'll just make the observation that I think virtually half of the episodes in season one, I think, could fall into that category.
Well, I think these are the reflections, honestly, of a flawed human being. Gene Roddenberry had his flaws.
Mm-hmm.
I have my flaws. You have your flaws. Sure. And I think anyone who has flaws and know they have flaws and are self-reflective about those flaws will naturally, at some point, ask him or herself, can we evolve to the point where these things are not part of human nature anymore? Mm-hmm. Do we have potential to get beyond these, you know, what are plausibly weaknesses of mankind? Or if we try to get beyond them, have we lost something else that's important as a corollary?
Right. I agree. So your next category is exploration of human nature. You preface that by saying these are kind of good versus evil episodes.
Well, there's a little bit of overlap with the second category here. You know, in the second category, the broad category of transhumanism, there are definitely questions of human nature in those episodes. Right. But I think in this third category, I see more of a conflict, you know, an internal struggle between good versus evil, or one part of our nature versus another part of our nature. So I think these are a substantively different category because they highlight not just sort of what our potential is from a third person standpoint or from an evolutionary standpoint, but what is the nature of the inner struggle that defines our moral character and our human nature as human beings. So the first...
And it occurs to me that I think we're probably going to overlap a few episodes here. I think that more than a couple of my choices, I think, could fall into this category. And I think, Zachary, if I know you, and we've been doing this for a long time, I think that I know where you're going to go with this. We'll see if I'm right.
I have exactly 2 episodes in this category, and there are probably more, and maybe you have more you want to add to the category. The first, I think, is the obvious pick, The Enemy Within.
Yes, that is, yes, on
you know,
list.
It's fascinating to take an internal struggle, you know, the pacifist side of you versus the violent side of you, or the good side versus the evil side, however you want to characterize it. Take those two components, split them into 2 different people, and see if those 2 people are functional human beings, or if those 2 parts of our nature need each other in some way.
Yeah, I love this episode. Again, this is going to be one of those episodes that's probably on one of my short lists of best Star Trek episodes. And I don't think it could have happened to a nicer guy than Captain Kirk. To get to see him split down the middle and really get to explore 2 very different sides of the same coin, I think, is just utterly fascinating. I think there are so many questions and so many interesting things going on in this episode as we explore, you know, these 2 very remarkably different people who make up the same Captain Kirk. And I think that Dr. McCoy's observation in that he says to Kirk, you know, you need that part of you. And suddenly Captain Kirk realizes that there is something very dark within him. And Dr. McCoy says, it's a part of you. You need it. And even Captain Kirk recognizes that he needs it.
I would say even more interesting, though, and it's not something that gets quite as much attention in the episode, is you could say the exact thing about the other half of Captain Kirk.
Absolutely.
You need the hesitancy and the tentativeness in order to temper that violent nature.
Without a doubt. And I think it speaks to the balance that every human being, I think, struggles in their life to make, striking this balance. I think it's every man's struggle, you know, to keep these two sides, not to put one on the back burner or to hold it at bay, but rather to strike this interesting balance. And I think, again, we see this in other episodes, but not done so brilliantly as to literally take a man and split him in two and explore those two sides of a man as two distinct individuals. And I think we've done the reverse of this. I think that Tuvix in Voyager, in a lot of ways, is this kind of reverse version of the enemy within, in that we took two distinct individuals and we made one.
I guess my only critique of the episode is that it's a little simplistic. There are obviously more than two facets to our personalities, more than one kind of moral flaw to have, right? So, and I think if you look at people, you know, I could look at you could look at me, I could look at whomever, and each person has a different kind of struggle, right? Sure. Maybe as a starship captain, you know, violence versus hesitancy is Captain Kirk's struggle. But I don't particularly relate to having a struggle with violence, so I don't relate to that aspect of Captain Kirk's personality very much. Although I have my own flaws and weaknesses, and so do you. And I just think if we took any given person and split him or her into two, it would be not necessarily the same two people we get in this episode with the two Captain Kirks.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think these two halves of Captain Kirk are what, and they make this observation in the episode. I mean, they say as much within the episode. What makes him a good captain is that he strikes the perfect balance between these two halves of himself.
I also put the conscience of the king, like I mentioned earlier.
That is on my list as well.
Yeah, because it raises an interesting question. You take someone like Kodos the Executioner, who is essentially committing genocide, you know, somewhat analogous to Hitler. And you ask the interesting question, are they genuinely evil? Or is there some story you can tell about that individual and the story they tell themselves and the reasons they would give for what they're doing that makes them not evil, just misunderstood or misguided in some way? It's an interesting exploration of the nature of good versus evil in human nature. You know, is there genuine evil out there, or are there just, you know, people who think of themselves as good people who do bad things for all the wrong reasons?
Yeah, and Zachary, I don't really have anything specific that I want to say about this episode. It was on my list as well. I knew that we were going to overlap here. But if our listeners want to listen to a much more detailed discussion regarding this episode, The Conscience of the King, they should go back into our back catalog. It is episode 83 of Metatrex, entitled Caesar of the Stars. We had about an hour and 20-minute discussion all around the topic of The Conscience of the King. And really, I think everything that I had to say, and certainly we had a great deal to say about this fantastic episode, can be found there in episode 83, Caesar of the Stars.
A mere five episodes ago.
Absolutely. I think there's another episode, Zachary, and it was one of my honorable mentions, I think, that falls along this line. If you recall, at the top of the podcast, I mentioned that I had an honorable mention that I think in many ways reflected the same philosophical kind of point that's being made with Enemy Within, and that is the alternative factor. I think it tells a very similar story that we get with the Enemy Within, in that there are two sides of this alien entity that is, they're struggling with one another. And so I think it fits in to this category, exploration of human nature, this idea of our inner good and our inner evil kind of, you know, at odds with one another. I think that's explored a great deal in The Alternative Factor, and I just found it fascinating. And I put it as an honorable mention because I think they explored this in just slightly better way with The Enemy Within. But nevertheless, I thought The Alternative Factor deserved mentioning on my list.
Well, I think these are some of the most introspective episodes of Star Trek because they come from within, right? We all experience some sort of struggle like this, right? Every person in some unique way has some sort of inner struggle. And it's interesting to take that inner struggle and find a way to represent it on the screen with separate people, like, you know, taking Captain Kirk, splitting him into two different people, and kind of putting that inner struggle on display for the world to see so we can talk about it and evaluate it and learn something from it in the course of watching Star Trek.
You know, I find it fascinating. There's a line within The Alternative Factor that I think is, to this day, I just find it fascinating. Lazarus is this entity that is matter, and he has an antimatter counterpart. And, you know, these two are just locked into this battle. And he says to Captain Kirk of his counterpart, he's death, anti-life, he lives to destroy. And, you know, it's interesting because I think that there is within every one of us the ability to sabotage, to self-destruct. And I think many of us, I know certainly I do. I struggle against that sometimes. You know, this part of me that, you know, every time I have something good in my life, you know, I find a way to just blow it up. And we come to a place where we have, you know, whatever it is that we've gone out there to seek and to find and to achieve in life. And when we have it, you know, it's not good enough. It's, you know, we don't find joy sometimes in the things that we think will bring us joy. And so I see that kind of introspective struggle here with Lazarus, but I find it fascinating that, you know, in many ways, these two characters, they look alike. They, you know, they're a lot alike, but yet, you know, they are so anti, you know, one another. It's like you know, Superman and Bizarro. It's fascinating to me that we can take these types of stories and just really kind of explore the human condition and our own ability to sabotage our own happiness and well-being.
We all have an internal mental dialogue. It's not a monologue. It's a dialogue.
Yeah.
Or more, maybe it's a plurality of voices and perspectives, but we all have some sort of internal struggle, you know, being pulled in multiple directions that we have to reconcile within ourselves. And it's just fun to see that what is essentially an internal struggle displayed externally on the screen in these episodes of Star Trek. I think that's fascinating.
But unlike The Enemy Within, these two Lazaruses cannot exist in the same universe. There's this great conversation that happens between Kirk and Spock in the episode, and Kirk asks Spock, you know, what happens if they meet? And Spock says to him rather dramatically, annihilation, Jim. Total, complete, absolute annihilation. So
when worlds collide.
When worlds collide. So there's actually a commentary here that there is something within us that needs to be suppressed.
Something that can annihilate?
because it's almost as though it's saying that if that antimatter side of us, if you will, is given the opportunity to exist in the same presence that we're in, that it can be destructive. And so, unlike The Enemy Within, where the two halves need one another, this episode's saying that there's a part of us that we can live without.
Or that you can't live in both at the same time.
So, I offer that up into your category, Exploration of Human Nature, as a third alternative.
Lazarus is a great addition to this theme, this category.
And finally, we have Ethics of War.
I don't have as much to say about this. It is important to remember that the original series was taking place in the context of the Cold War. There are interesting moral and ethical questions about the nature of war. I'm not sure these episodes have a whole lot to say about war philosophically, but it's an important theme of the original series. These are important episodes. You know, we do have this fundamental question about war. Like, what should our relationship to the enemy be? Are they human beings like we are? Are we superior in some way? Are we right? Are they right? How do we reconcile? Do we recognize their humanity or not? And the first episode on my list here is Balance of Terror. And I put this on my list because I think Balance of Terror raises this very interesting question about viewing the enemy as an equal. I think we tend to view ourselves as superior to our enemies in some way. You know, in the height of the Cold War, we were the morally superior nation, and the USSR was inept in some way, morally inept or corrupt, or, you know, doesn't have the same ideals we have. Mm-hmm. But you take these two starship commanders, you know, and force them to recognize each other's equality in a one-on-one battle situation. There's also almost a little bit of game theory involved here, the sort of guessing cat and mouse game of,
yes,
you know, fighting each other. So you could characterize this as a game theory episode, but I think more interesting to me in this episode is the brute force recognition of our humanity. You could also characterize this episode as an interesting, dramatic representation of Thomas Hobbes's state of nature. You take two people, put them in a room, strip away all of the sort of moral and societal influences. You have scarcity. You know, I've got to eat or you have to eat. Mm-hmm. I have the same abilities you do, and it's me versus you. It, you know, we're outside civilized society at that point, where we're all fundamentally equal. And I think the one-on-one battle aspect of this episode reinforces that brute force Hobbesian equality, that fundamentally it's me versus you, and I've got the same abilities you do, and we're all equal when we're in that one-on-one situation.
What else do you have?
I have A Taste of Armageddon. So if you remember, in A Taste of Armageddon, we get what's essentially a simulated war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, costs and casualties and victories and losses are all calculated. The requisite number of people have to submit themselves for what's essentially an execution. And the war is waged virtually without the loss.
It's War Games 20 years before it ever hit the big screen.
Exactly. It is War Games. This episode makes an interesting claim, which is that the conflict is not going to go away. There will still be a need to struggle. But if we can find a way to virtualize it, you know, essentially play a video game and I take my losses and you take your losses without the actual losses, then we can have our struggle, but in a more civilized way. It's a very interesting thesis to make. It's not that we can eliminate war altogether. It's that we can find a more evolved way to do it that doesn't involve so much chaos.
So, Zachary, that wraps up your category, Ethics of War. So we've covered your categories, Moral Choices, Ethical Conundrums. We've covered transhumanism. We've covered the exploration of human nature, this idea of our inner good versus our inner evil. And now we've covered Ethics of War. So you have given us your final episode on your list of essential Trek philosophy. I actually have two more episodes that were on my list. And again, I had four episodes that were on my list of essential Trek philosophy. And just to reiterate what I said at the beginning of this podcast, it was incredibly difficult. And this entire list of episodes, all 29 of them, I think, could be considered essential Trek philosophy.
Wait, you had four episodes on your list, and I had about 15 on my list.
Yes.
And out of those four, only two were on my list of 15?
No. out of your list of 15, we share four in common.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying you had four.
Yeah,
and
we actually share four in common. So I have two episodes left. So I had a list of four with two honorable mentions. The alternative factor was an honorable mention. I'm going to go back to my main list. This Side of Paradise was on my list. And Apart from the fact that we get to see Spock high in this episode,
altered states of consciousness, the philosophy of altered states of consciousness. There's nothing more 60s than this episode.
Yes, we got to see Spock's altered states of consciousness, which I think that in and of itself is a spectacle. But the thing that I gravitated towards, this is really, in a lot of ways, this is before Holodex. So I think that in later iterations of Star Trek, you know, Barclay, I think, was a great exploration of kind of the same theme that we see here. And that is, we have a situation where people are living a lie and they have to make a decision at the end of the episode. Do they live with the lie, or which, you know, is that's paradise. And even Spock became influenced by the environment. So the environment of this planet is altering the state of the people that live there. And so they have to make a choice. You know, are they willing to give that up to live in reality, or to live in this kind of make-believe, this pseudo existence that they live in? I'm not sure exactly what the commentary was about. Was it the obvious? You know, was this in some ways a, you know, snap out of it and stop dropping LSD for the 60s, you know, drug culture? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. I really don't. That's a question, I think, for, you know, Nathan Butler and DC Fontana. But what I do know is that it's this really interesting conversation that goes on within the episode that really asks the question, you know, are you willing to trade the truth for a lie and live in it? And so we explored this many times. Again, I think Barclay was probably the next generation's kind of version of what this episode was all about.
You make an interesting point that this is essentially a holodeck episode, analogous to the holodeck mm-hmm. episodes that we get in The Next Generation. Maybe that's what I like about Shore Leave, honestly. We talked about Shore Leave earlier in the episode. Shore Leave is essentially a holodeck episode as well. If anything you want can be manifested, anything you happen to be thinking about, anything you desire, that is holodeck-like as well. And it raises the same question, you know, if we got everything you want, would you live in that fantasy world versus living in reality?
So, Zachary, not to belabor the point, but my other honorable mention, this is my other episode. So we have this side of paradise that was on my list of four, essential Trek philosophy. I had the alternative factor as an honorable mention. My other honorable mention was the episode Devil in the Dark. I'm a sucker for the Horta.
And it's an episode that we talked about previously on Metatrex.
Yes, it is. And I won't go into a great deal of commentary about it because I feel like we have talked extensively about this episode.
Well, I think there are two important things about that episode worth noting. One is that it is more of a question of philosophy of biology. What is the definition of life? And are mm-hmm. there fringe kinds of beings that we may or may not accept as life that properly should count as life? You know, that's different from the life we know here on Earth. It's an interesting question in philosophy of biology. It's an interesting question scientifically. But it also raises the question of recognizing the sameness in the other, right? It's in a way, it's similar to Balance of Terror, recognizing the things we have in common, even with beings that are radically different from us in other ways.
It's for that reason, the definition of life. It's this exploration. And at the beginning of the episode, you don't realize that this creature, although entirely different, in many ways very similar to a human being, in that it was only trying to protect its eggs, its young, and its reaction was that of self-defense. You know, the observation was made within the episode, you know, well, it killed a man, you know, and for that reason, you know, it needed to die. The Horta must die.
Do you know, Mike, that in an early draft of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the original plot was for the crew of the Enterprise to go back in time to save two Horta and bring them back into the 23rd century? Save the Horta!
Captain, there'll be Horta here.
Save the Horta. Save the Horta.
For sure. Well, Zachary, we've got quite a list here.
Save the Horta.
Save the Horta. We've got quite a list here of essential Trek philosophy from season one. I'm going to go down through this list, but I'm going to preface this by saying something that I said at the very top of today's podcast, and that is this season, I just don't believe that there is a single episode, and again, we disagree on shore leave, and for your sake, I'm going to leave shore leave in there and just say
thank
that
you.
There were 29 episodes plus The Cage, so 30 episodes of Star Trek here for the first season, and every single one of them deserve to be on a list of essential Trek philosophy. And I will say to our listeners out there, if you really want to go back and do a rewatch of Star Trek, if you have not sat down and watched season one of the original series in a while, you owe it to yourself to sit down and do it. There's not, again, a single episode that I would exclude from a list of essential Trek philosophy. But here it is, listeners. Mike and Zachary's picks for essential Trek philosophy, season one of the original series. They are City on the Edge of Forever, The Cage, The Arena, Errand of Mercy, The Return of the Archons, Space Seed, Where No Man Has Gone Before, What Are Little Girls Made Of, Miri, Dagger of the Mind, The Enemy Within, The Conscience of the King, The Alternative Factor, Balance of Terror, A Taste of Armageddon, This Side of Paradise, and Devil in the Dark. Zachary, that is essential Trek philosophy from season one, Star Trek, the original season.
You forgot one.
I forgot one.
Charlie X.
Charlie X.
Let's add that to the list.
Let's add Charlie.
We talked about it. It came up in the context of my second category.
Yes, absolutely. Charlie X. Yeah, so that's quite a list, Zachary. Nearly half of the episodes from season one made it onto our list. But again, let me say, I just don't think there's a single episode from the first season of Star Trek, the original series, that should be excluded.
Well, like we said at the beginning of the show, the entire history of Star Trek that we know owes its existence to the first season of the original series. And the fact that we had such a large list of essential Trek philosophy, larger than any other essential Trek philosophy list that we've come up with in any other season of Star Trek, laid the foundation for everything we know and love about Star Trek. It was such a strong season, but it was strong not just dramatically, it was strong because it's full of ideas, philosophical ideas. These are the kinds of things that fire the imagination. They get us thinking about who we are and what we could become, what our nature is, what our inner struggles are. And these are questions of humanity that everyone can relate to.
Without a doubt. You know, I think about Gene Roddenberry, Gene Kuhn, DC Fontana. These names to me are revered because of what they were able to create and the way they were able to explore the human condition, I think, in ways that, here we are, Zachary. I think there's no greater testament to what Gene and his crew of writers and professionals were able to put together than the fact that here we are 51 years later, still talking about it with just such awe and reverence for what they created.
I do feel a little bad that I broke your schema for how we do essential Trek philosophy. I just couldn't stick to the normal rules.
Well, you are a rule breaker, and at least
half of me is.
I appreciate you at least half. And Zachary, you need that half. You need that.
Okay. Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about saving the Horta today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere around the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey!
Do you have to have the stick to be the grand proxy?
The scepter?
Yeah. I see it as a walking stick.
Is that supposed to be the Grand Negus's scepter? Is that the actual one?
Oh,
my gosh. It's a replica, of course, but is it supposed to be the actual one?
I don't know, but what it reminds me of totally is old Biff from Back to the Future, old Biff, yes, with his cane that he hits people on the head with. That is totally it.
Hello! McFly!
Think, McFly, think.
Standard orbit.
People are coming over and they're introducing people to him, and it's my turn. And he goes, Steve, Jimmy, I want you to meet the host of the convention. This is Stephen Last. And I go, pleased to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you, Mr. Dewan. And he goes, hi, Steve. Nice to meet you. And he's like, what? What? You mean you don't talk like that?
The 602 Club.
In particular, I noticed that the most with either Elastigirl or Violet, because it's sort of like you and I were talking about before the show, Helen, Elastigirl, really shows that she's Elastigirl not only in what she does as a superhero, but in showing the things that a regular mom has to deal with, you know, whether you're a single mom or, you know, a big family. It's something that traditionally they're trying to show that a parent goes through.
Warp 5.
Right, because Frankenstein himself, like, it doesn't really mistreat the monster, right? They've got him locked up, chained up and whatnot, right? Because they don't know what to do with him, I guess. Like, now that I've made this corpse, well, now what, right? Like yeah. You know, it's not like a puppy.
Never
right?
thinking like, about the end game. Just like all those, you know, master villains. It's like, yeah, you rule the world and then what?
Right.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of Metatrex, and there are many ways for you to mind-meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatrex. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, speaking of contact information, Mike, when you're not busy designing your Android body, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
That's quite a task. And when I'm not doing that, you can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Be glad to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with you in the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not advocating for the preservation of the Horta, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the oldest old one that we know.
And dare I say, there is no greater advocate of Horta in the galaxy.
Save the Horta. Hashtag save the Horta. We'd also like to thank our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, my former co-host on To the Journey, at Choco Weeble on Twitter. Norman Lau, you can find Norm at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker from Parts Unknown. And Mike, we'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.